is you're a specialist on pushing tobacco on the world. Now you're talking about climate. What is the model that was used? We just have about 30 seconds.
It's important to understand that the UN climate talks are the exception, not the norm. Other UN bodies, institutions around the world, they all begin with making sure that there's insulation from keeping the source of the problem out of solving the problem. That's happened with the UN Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, as you mentioned, but it has never happened here. So now we are so far into the process, we are running out of time. We must kick big polluters out. We must end their ability to write the rules of climate action. We must end their ability to bankroll these climate talks and reset the system so that it can finally end fossil fuels and advance real solutions and save millions of lives that don't need to be lost.
Well, Rachel Rose Jackson, we thank you so much for being with us. Director of Climate Research and Policy at Corporate Accountability and the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition released the report, Record Number of Fossil Fuel Lobbyists at COP28. We'll link to your report.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Why am I passionate about KBOO? Well, I am pretty certain that I am passionate about KBOO because I realize that it is a very effective platform that provides the community with an opportunity to express themselves. That's what it did to me when they brought me here back in 2014. I knew nothing about radio or KBOO, but I had experience recording before. So I was experienced in that sense. So it kind of came natural, but it definitely has taught me just being at KBOO and volunteering for KBOO. Creating content, creating segments for Rosetta Native Radio. It gave me the opportunity to really express myself, my thoughts, my philosophies, my culture, and be confident about the way that you can express yourself. So that's why I'm passionate about KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, heavy rains in the region close schools on the coast and cancel Amtrak service from Portland to Seattle. The off-duty pilot who attempted to turn off the engines of a Horizon Airlines flight faces lesser charges. And advocates press Washington State to do more to protect people against the health hazards of cooking with gas. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our end of the year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Schools on the Oregon coast were closed today due to heavy rain and road closures. U.S. Highway 101 was closed between Seaside and Highway 26 nearly 3 miles because of flooding during this morning's high tide. The Oregon Department of Transportation warns drivers anywhere on the coast that they should slow down for stormy conditions and keep an eye out for standing water on the roads. A flood watch is in place for northwestern Oregon and southwestern Washington through Wednesday afternoon. The National Weather Service says people shouldn't walk through floodwaters. It only takes 6 inches to knock someone off their feet and 12 inches of water to float a small car. A landslide somewhere on the Amtrak line between Portland and Seattle means no rail service between the cities until at least Thursday morning. The rain that's swamping the Northwest is the cause of the landslide, though Amtrak didn't say where exactly the landslide is. The cancellation doesn't impact trains running between Portland and Eugene or trains between Seattle and Vancouver, British Columbia. The company says they're helping travelers with alternative bookings because of the cancellation. The White House presses for supplemental Ukraine aid. Leaders condemn anti-Semitic attacks during Gaza ceasefire protests. And, despite concerns about the next election, one Arizona legal expert says courts generally side with voters and democracy. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Any member of Congress who does not support funding for Ukraine is voting for an outcome that will make it easier for Putin to prevail.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warns that a vote against more Ukraine aid would help Russia. A Senate test vote is likely today on the White House's $106 billion Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and border security spending package. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says lawmakers have less than 2 weeks to pass what he calls urgent national security priorities.
It's in America's national security interest, and that we shouldn't hesitate to give Ukraine the weapons it needs to do the job.
Israeli forces are now striking Khan Yunis, the largest city in southern Gaza, where thousands of civilians from the north sought refuge. Meanwhile, Bar Ilan University professor Ruth Halperin Kadari says video footage and hostage testimony confirms that Hamas intentionally used sexual violence as a tactic.
Leaving no doubt that all this was a premeditated plan to use rape and to use sexual assault as a weapon of war against Israelis on October 7.
About 500 people in Philadelphia called for a ceasefire during the Flood Philly for Gaza protests Saturday. One group gathered outside Goldie, a Jewish-owned restaurant. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro called the protest a blatant act of anti-Semitism on social media. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has also made similar warnings.
After October 7th, Jewish Americans are feeling singled out, targeted, and isolated. In many ways, we feel alone.
Former President Donald Trump is telling his supporters to guard the vote, which some see as a veiled threat to a peaceful election. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the federal government has a limited say about this, and protecting the ballot often has to happen at the state level.
Every state has their own kind of process, so certainly not going to preempt that and talk about what states are doing or what that may look like for any of these battleground states.
Victoria Lopez with the ACLU of Arizona says that state, along with Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, saw the most court cases on election denial and voting processes in 2022. Lopez says most often, democracy won.
The final outcome of some of these cases has not been yet determined, but at least the majority of those cases that have been filed, the outcome has been pro-voter, pro-democracy outcomes.
The EPA just announced new standards to slash emissions from oil and gas operations. Stephanie Rees with Moms Clean Air Force says the agency and the Biden administration are taking bold action to protect health and the climate.
These rules are a critical step to cut methane pollution and address the health impacts from oil and gas operations on our most vulnerable populations.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The off-duty pilot who tried to shut off the engines of a Horizon airline flight won't face 83 attempted murder charges. The man was allegedly in a drug-induced mental health crisis. A grand jury decided that Joseph David Emerson will instead face 83 misdemeanor endangerment charges and one felony charge, endangering an aircraft. If he's convicted, the punishment for those crimes is far lighter. Back in October, Emerson was sitting in the cockpit on a flight from Everett to San Francisco when he declared, quote, "I am not okay," and tried to cut the plane's fuel supply mid-flight. Court documents show he told police, quote, "I pulled both the emergency shutoff handles because I thought I was dreaming and I just want to wake up. I was trying to wake up. I didn't feel like this was real," end quote. He told officers he hadn't slept for more than 40 hours at the time of the incident and took psychedelic mushrooms 2 days before. Emerson was arrested October 22nd. He's also charged with a federal crime, interfering with a flight crew member and attendants. He has pled not guilty to all crimes. The U.S. Senate confirmed more than 400 military nominees this afternoon. That's because Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville lifted his hold on all military promotions over a Defense Department policy that allows service members to be reimbursed for travel costs related to getting an abortion. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer took to the Senate floor to confirm all 425 nominees unanimously. Tuberville held up the nominees for 10 months, even getting backlash from within his own party. He's maintained a hold on around 10 four-star generals. Senators of both parties had made a plan to temporarily go around the rules of the chamber to confirm the military nominees, but were reluctant to break with tradition. Studies show that cooking with gas inside your home creates negative health impacts, particularly for your children. A coalition of 19 groups has sent a letter to the Washington State Department of Health urging the agency to warn the public about negative health impacts of burning gas. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The American Gas Association misled the public on the health effects of burning gas for decades. Now a coalition wants the Washington State Department of Health to set the record straight. 19 groups signed a letter to the agency calling for it to detail the public health impacts from burning gas in homes and buildings. Past president of the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, Mark Vossler, says his organization and others wrote the letter because the Department of Health has an important role in informing the public about health risks.
Now that we know about the health risks of burning gas for heating and cooking, it makes perfect sense that the Department of Health can take an active role in shifting us away from unhealthy practices toward healthier practices.
The effects of burning gas inside homes, such as from gas stoves, includes a 42% increase in asthma symptoms among kids because of exposure to pollutants such as nitrogen dioxide. The American Gas Association says gas ranges are a minor source of nitrogen dioxide. The groups that signed the letter to the Department of Health note burning gas also impacts outdoor air quality. Ruth Sawyer with Sierra Club Washington says cleaner alternatives are available, and the state has committed to a completely clean energy grid by 2040.
There's a whole diversity of sources of renewable and clean energy that the state is going to be investing in over the next many years to transition our electricity to be fully clean and renewable.
Vossler says we should no longer put people at risk by burning gas.
Making an effort to reduce both indoor and outdoor pollution will save lives.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek is forgiving uncollected traffic fines and fees that are keeping people from getting their driver's licenses back. If that sounds familiar, it's because former Governor Kate Brown did it too, only her executive order left some 10,000 residents out. In 2020, the state legislature passed House Bill 4210, which outlawed suspending people's licenses for not paying traffic fines. It wasn't retroactive, though, so people who still owed money for things like parking tickets didn't get to benefit. It only applies to traffic fines and fees, not fees for traffic crimes or money that's owed to victims. Kotek said in a statement, quote, "Debt-based driver's license suspensions disproportionately impact rural and low-income Oregonians. For families who are already struggling to make ends meet, these orders remove one more barrier to financial stability," end quote. Oregonians can find out if they qualify for forgiveness by going to the Department of Motor Vehicles website, oregon.gov/odot/DMV, and searching for fine remittance. Oregonians are no stranger to strains on their public defense system. A ruling earlier this year declared that those accused of a crime must be released from jail within 7 days if the court can't find an attorney for them. A shortage of public defenders has created problems in the criminal justice system in other parts of the country, too. The Mississippi Supreme Court ruled in April that poor defendants must have a lawyer throughout the entire criminal process, from initial arrest to indictment. But many courts in the state have not been following this rule. As a result, defendants are left in a dead zone without an attorney for months at a time. Danielle Smith has more.
Imagine you're stuck in jail, innocent until proved guilty, with no one to fight for your freedom. That's the reality for thousands in Mississippi. Despite a Mississippi Supreme Court ruling requiring legal representation for people accused of a crime pre-indictment, implementation of the rule has been inconsistent. A Marshall Project investigation by staff writer Caleb Bedillion sheds light on Mississippi's troubling pre-trial public defense system. The state must provide an initial appearance within 48 hours, but it has no time limit for indictment. This loophole keeps people in jail for months, even years, before they're even formally charged. Bedillion's reporting, based on House testimonies, expose that many courts lack compliance plans.
So you're in jail, your case can't move forward because you haven't been indicted yet, and you don't have an attorney. Local reformers and criminal justice advocates have called this the dead zone. You initially had an attorney, then you didn't, and you don't get another one until you've been indicted, and then you move to what we call circuit court.
According to the Prison Policy Initiative, 27,000 people are incarcerated in Mississippi. Public defense reform legislation is expected to be introduced in the state legislative session that starts in January. While past reform bills haven't gained traction, the dead zone problem and other issues could renew momentum for a comprehensive overhaul of the state's public defense system. Bedillion says Mississippi's public defense system is fragmented, lacking standards and resources for fair representation for the accused. He explains some states have an office of public defenders that handle all cases, while others have public defenders' offices in each county or felony court jurisdiction. Mississippi is the opposite, with each court handling it differently.
We have very few full-time public defenders, so when you go to that initial appearance, that court probably just has someone on contract who works part-time, and then once you're done with that initial appearance, they think they fulfilled the terms of their contract. And then when you move to the circuit court, they have an entirely different set of public defenders.
He adds that out of 82 Mississippi counties, only 6 or 7 have full-time public defenders. Bedillion encourages the loved ones of those who are behind bars without indictment and cannot afford a lawyer to request a public defender. He adds the new rule says they have the right, and ignoring it breaks the rules. I'm Danielle Smith, Mississippi News Connection. This story was based on original reporting by Caleb Bedillion with the Marshall Project.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on last night's public meeting on the Portland City Attorney's change to the Police Accountability Commission's plan for voter-approved police oversight. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 55 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1934, American writer and journalist Joan Didion was born. She was part of the New Journalism movement, known for her writings on the counterculture of the 60s and in the 80s and 90s on the political rhetoric of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. She also notably wrote one of the earliest mainstream articles to suggest the Central Park Five had been wrongly convicted. The quote of the day is from Didion, who wrote in her book, The Year of Magical Thinking, quote, "We are imperfect mortal beings, aware of that mortality even when we push it away, failed by our very complication, so wired that when we mourn our losses, we also mourn, for better or for worse, ourselves, as we were, as we are no longer, as we will one day not be at all." The Navajo Nation marks the passing of former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and a virtual conference on issues facing the Columbia River convened Native tribes and environmental groups last week. With those stories and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The first woman Supreme Court justice has died. Sandra Day O'Connor died early Friday morning in Phoenix at the age of 93 due to complications related to advanced dementia and a respiratory illness. The 25th Navajo Nation Council and Speaker Crystalline Curley said in a statement, quote, "It's important to acknowledge Sandra Day O'Connor's influence on the American justice system by being the first woman appointed to serve as a Supreme Court justice. In Diné culture, we honor the symbiotic relationship that exists between men and women," end quote. O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1981 by President Ronald Reagan and unanimously confirmed by the Senate. She served on the court for 25 years. Prior to her tenure in the Supreme Court, she was a judge and an elected official in Arizona, serving as the first female majority leader of a state Senate as the Republican leader in the Arizona Senate. She was honored in 2009 with the Presidential Medal of Freedom for helping transform the American judiciary by paving the way for women to join the nation's highest court. She was often referred to as the most powerful woman in America. The 25th Navajo Nation Council sends their condolences to the family of Sandra Day O'Connor. The virtual conference to discuss issues facing the Columbia River was held last week online that brought together Native tribes and interested parties. Steve Jackson tells us about the Transboundary Water Governance and Ethics Symposium.
Participants in the virtual conference addressed issues like climate change, the effect of the dams on endangered salmon, and water quality. One who spoke was D.R. Michelle, Colville tribal member, and spokesman for the Upper Columbia United Tribes. Spoke of tribal efforts to reintroduce native salmon above major dams like Chief Joseph Dam, where they haven't existed for 80 years.
Early on in some of these studies, when we talked about doing cultural and educational releases, folks would say, oh, those fish aren't going to know what to do or how to, they've been out of those waters so long, they're not going to remember. And that first bass of fish we turned loose above Chief Joe went straight up the river, went heading for home, heading for the headwaters where for thousands of years they've been. And after everything we've done to them, they've still got that instinct, that desire to get to those spawning grounds.
The conference was billed as a continuation of a dialogue that began before the COVID pandemic. It was organized to discuss serious issues that threaten the well-being of the river system, issues that weren't addressed when the Columbia River Treaty between the U.S. and Canada was signed in 1964. Negotiations are underway now behind closed doors to renew the treaty, which originally addressed flood control and hydropower management. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The rate of suicides involving a firearm are increasing nationwide, according to a new report. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports Indigenous people are seeing the largest increase.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there were about 27,000 suicides involving a firearm nationwide in 2022. That's according to preliminary data. The rate of suicide by firearm increased by 11% from 2019 through 2022. Rates increased among all racial groups, but Indigenous Americans saw the largest increase at 66%. The CDC says that could be attributed to lack of access to mental health care, high unemployment rates, and isolation in Indigenous communities, all issues exacerbated by the pandemic. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Tribal leaders from across California and the nation are headed to the nation's capital for the White House Tribal Nations Summit, which starts tomorrow. Many California tribes are asking lawmakers and President Joe Biden to further protect more tribal land currently managed by federal agencies. Suzanne Potter has the details.
California tribes are headed to the White House Tribal Nations Summit tomorrow, where they will ask Congress and the Biden administration to create or expand several national monuments. The Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla tribe in the Coachella Valley would like the president to establish a new Chuckwalla National Monument and expand Joshua Tree National Park. Torres Martinez Chairman Thomas Tortas says the area is an important wildlife corridor.
The proposed monument would preserve this cultural landscape by providing protections to multi-use trail systems established by our ancestors, sacred sites and objects, traditional cultural places, geoglyphs, petroglyphs, pictographs, plants, and wildlife.
Since taking office, President Joe Biden has created 5 national monuments using the Antiquities Act. Congress is also considering legislation to create or enlarge national monuments. The 2-day summit draws leaders from across the nation to discuss a range of issues. President Rudy Ortega Jr. of the Fernandinho Tataviam Band of Mission Indians wants Biden to add another 109,000 acres to the San Gabriel Mountains National Monument.
In Los Angeles, we're massively overgrown, and we need to protect these landscapes so that it doesn't further continue the construction of houses and businesses and so on, but an area to give green space.
Brandy McDaniels is the Pitt River Nation's lead for the Satitla National Monument, which, if established, would protect a little more than 200,000 acres in the Medicine Lake Highlands area near Mount Shasta.
Satitla is culturally, historically, and scientifically important to the world, serving as a buffer to climate change, and provides immense amounts of pure water, natural storage, and resources to a large portion of California.
Tribes are also seeking an expansion of the Berryessa Snow National Monument in Lake County. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Hopes that a ceasefire in Israel would lead to a long-term resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have been dashed as fighting resumes and expands to the south in Gaza. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on total victory over Hamas has become a major obstacle to the release of all hostages and a permanent ceasefire. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In an opinion article published in the Washington Post November 18, President Biden described his ambitions beyond the 4-day pause in fighting that had just been agreed upon. Our goal, he said, should not be simply to stop the war. It should be to end the war forever, break the cycle of increasing violence, and build something stronger in Gaza and across the Middle East so that history does not stop repeating itself. Optimists had hoped for an indefinite extension of the ceasefire that would lead not only to the release of all hostages, but also to a lasting solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. But now that is very unlikely to happen, and the principal obstruction is Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He has short and long-term goals, only a few of which accord with Biden's. Netanyahu announced 3 short-term goals on November 26 while meeting with soldiers in Gaza, quote, eliminate Hamas, return all of our hostages, and ensure that Gaza will not go back to being a threat to the state of Israel. I am here to tell the soldiers who all tell me the same thing, and I repeat it to you, citizens of Israel, we are continuing until the end, until victory. Nothing will stop us, and we are convinced that we have the force, the strength, the will, and the determination to achieve all of our goals for the war, and this is what we will do. But Netanyahu's long-term goals are even more ambitious and more troubling, to remain in power and prevent a 2-state solution. He sees the war as an exit from the battle over judicial reform that consumed Israel prior to October 7 and threatened his hold on power. The far right's proposals to gut the essential powers of the Supreme Court were under daily assault from Israeli society across the board, including military reservists. Then came the Hamas atrocities and an opportunity to again be a wartime leader. Netanyahu knows full well from opinion polls that the great majority of Israelis want him to step down after the war. He also faces pressure from his far-right cabinet members to push for total victory and give lower priority to a ceasefire and release of hostages. Thus, Netanyahu wants to keep the war going, and the improbable war aims he has set, the elimination of Hamas and the release of all the hostages, which includes about 70 soldiers, provide justification for staying in office for some time to come. Then there's Netanyahu's characterization of the war as an epic struggle for Israel's very existence. He's using language borrowed from George W. Bush after the 9/11 attack. The war is not just against terrorists, it is to preserve civilization itself. Netanyahu first made that argument in a meeting with the Netherlands Prime Minister, saying, quote, we are in a battle of civilization against barbarism. In a commentary for the Wall Street Journal on October 30th, entitled The Battle for Civilization, Netanyahu expanded on the point, insisting that unless Hamas and Iran are defeated, America will be next. Bush used 9/11 to conduct a war on terror that engulfed the U.S. and Middle East conflicts for years after. Netanyahu's purpose seems to be to solidify his rule and bring the U.S., the European Union, and others around to the view that Israel's fight is theirs, requiring political and military support well into the future. In a cruel sense, Netanyahu's goals coincide with those of Hamas, long-term warfare to gain one's objectives of eradicating the enemy. As I have noted before, Hamas leaders see this war as just one cycle of several to eliminate Israel. They, like Netanyahu, don't want the war to end in a way that ensures their irrelevancy. With two adversaries each seeking an all-or-nothing solution to the fighting, a long-term ceasefire seems out of the question. And so long as that is so, any discussion of a new approach to Gaza's political future cannot begin. That suits Netanyahu just fine. He has long favored keeping the West Bank and Gaza divided. Thus, when talking these days about post-war Gaza, Netanyahu and other senior Israeli officials are vague. First, they say Hamas must be defeated. Only then might a reconstructed civilian authority, Netanyahu's words, or an international coalition or joint forces, the words of Israeli President Isaac Herzog, be installed. No one in Tel Aviv wants to accept the Biden-Blinken idea of having the Palestinian Authority preside over Gaza, since giving the PA that new authority might be the prelude to Palestinian statehood. Now that the fighting has resumed and expanded into the south of Gaza, we need to reflect on the realities of this war. Ceasefires are temporary, the fighting is permanent. The Gaza death toll stands at around 15,000. About half the buildings there have been either badly damaged or destroyed, and some 40 hostages are apparently being held by forces other than Hamas. Many of the young men in Gaza who have lived through Israel's attack will be recruited into a revived Hamas. And in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu is still in command, blocking roads to peace. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Jill Freitas, Alex Gonzalez, Danielle Smith, Eric Galatas, and Joe Ullery. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently